Feminist Internet is a group of artists and designers working to advance internet equalities for women and other marginalized groups through critical practice. The Feminist Internet podcast is commissioned and produced by Somerset House Studios with the support of the University of the Arts London Creative Computing Institute. Over the series, it will explore the theme of recoding spaces, both online and offline, with the aim of diversifying internet spaces metaphorically, physically, and digitally, intercepting homogenous zones and breaking the filter bubble. The podcast aims to not only expose these spaces, but to regenerate them in new and inclusive ways.
Queerness means having a political sensibility alongside your sexual identity.
Freedom. Nothing is set in stone. There is not one way of being queer.
And people question their queerness a lot, but sometimes I think questioning your queerness is probably like the queerest thing that you can do.
Queerness is something that's spoiling and ruining dominant structures of power.
I like the word queer. It's strong. It's claiming your space.
Otherness.
It is about being other and being unapologetic.
It is a self-definition. Anyone who wants to belong to that bracket, it can be as wide as possible inside the word queer.
And queer, perhaps, is more in your face. And fuck you, if that's okay to say.
It has nothing to do with gender, sexuality, cultural background, you know. You can be queer. Anyone can be queer who believe we are, you know, queer together.
No shame. Living that world in a strong, brave way, I think.
I think it's a good word, personally.
If you feel queer, you are. That's all I can say.
The Feminist Internet Podcast.
Recoding Utopias, the importance of queer spaces.
Recoding Utopias.
I'm Clara.
I'm Connor.
And you're listening to the Feminist Internet Podcast. We're exploring how queerness is rendered through space, whether that be nightlife, technologies, through policy or archive. We'll be speaking to the people at the forefront of these spaces. So, Connor, can you tell us a little bit about queerness?
So, queerness is usually placed in relation to LGBT+, which is an abbreviated system to describe identities such as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender. And the plus is usually used to express further identities such as pansexual, asexual, transsexual and intersex, and more. It's arguably quite a hierarchical system, and the plus is used as a tool to acknowledge further identities, but that has lost the ability to comfortably allow the addition of new identities.
Enter queerness, which rids itself of binary thinking altogether. A general understanding of queerness is that it's an umbrella term used to describe non-normative identities in relation to gender and sexuality. It's an all-encompassing term that could include a cisgendered woman, a transgender individual, or someone who identifies as non-binary, for example.
So I identify as queer in regards to my sexuality, but I am also exploring how it affects my politics and mindset as well. I think you can sink deeper into this by looking at queer through the act of queerness and the act of queering. So we'll be hearing from them a little later on, but Lucas LaRochelle, who's the creator of the online queer archive Queering the Map, has noticed that the Google definition of queering is to spoil or to ruin. Also, the Google's definition of queer itself is the state or condition of being strange. So these definitions could be seen as a little problematic. However, it's useful to see queerness or queering as being something that's able to disrupt an existing system. So that could be heteronormativity, capitalism, gender binaries, technology even, or club nights, party.
These are fairly introductory understandings of what queer can be, but what we really want to do is look at queerness and how it manifests in spaces. We have some amazing individuals here who in some way or another have cultivated a queer space.
So we'll be exploring all these aspects of queer space in this episode, which features a number of guests, including Amy LeMay, the Night Czar of London, Nadine Ottois from Pussy Palace, Jim McSweeney from Gaze the Word Bookshop, Ingo Kando from Whatever World, and Lucas LaRochelle, the creator of Queering the Map.
It's important to understand that queer spaces don't just pop out of nowhere, and it's queer people who make queer spaces happen. But in the last decade alone, 58% of LGBTQ+ venues have closed. In an amazing project called The Urban Pamphleteer by University College London, they investigate London's queer nightlife past, present, and future. They highlight that queer nightlife has a long history tied to liberation movements and its ability to supply the needs of queer people with the security of safe spaces. It's important to understand that while queer rights have progressed, this is nuanced and varied for different people. The reality of the situation is that hate crime, homelessness, and mental health issues are still widely prevalent in the queer community. So with that being said, we're going to hear why queer spaces are so vital, how to protect them, and how queering can be taken beyond the club.
But the club is a good place to start.
Nadine Artois is a queer femme Desi DJ community leader and culture consultant. They are co-founder of nightlife collective Pussy Palace.
A friend of mine, Sky Barr, she moved in with me in this house in Brick Lane, and we were just really frustrated with nightlife at the time. We were going to a lot of different things. We were going to gay bars, we were going to West End clubs, we were going to like underground things as well, like underground music kind of scenes. We had to always sacrifice something for the sake of a good night out, whether that's what we were wearing, how we were conducting ourselves, how we were dancing. You know, it's always be something we couldn't like tick all the boxes. So we started partying in the house. I could like DJ a little bit at the time and had some equipment. You know, we could listen to the music we wanted, we could dress how we wanted, and we had a level of control because it was our house. So, and we did that for about a year, and I have three cats, and one of them had kittens, and someone was like, oh, it's like a pussy palace in here, and the name just sort of like stuck. We were asked multiple times to take it outside of the house, but we were like, no, we don't want to do that. And about a year later, when, you know, we had like so many people outside our house trying to like pay money to like get in, we were like, maybe we should. So someone offered us a space, and we were like, let's try it. And it was a success. Like, a lot of people came down, it seemed like quite fun, but something was kind of off, but couldn't really put our fingers on it. Then the following month we did another one, and I was sexually harassed at that party by someone who tried to pretend that it was his night. And me, you know, I'm just Glaswegian and I'm kind of all about banter, so you know, I tried to like make a joke out of it, and he got really angry, and I was like, what the hell is this? So we talked about it afterwards, me and Sky, and we were like, if we're going to do this, we have to like put our like politics, our like ethos, like into the party. And I identify as a queer brown person, so I was like, I need that to those people to be prioritized if we're going to do that. It doesn't feel like that, but the parties inside the house do. So how do we do that? So my friend of mine, Monroe Bergdorf, been partying together for years, and she was on the same kind of like path as me online, and we talk a lot about race, gender, and be very vocal and angry about things that were happening in society. So I just reached out to her and I was like, hey babes, I've got this thing, I don't know what it is yet, but I think you should get involved. So she became a resident DJ, and then we along the line, we had, it was a bit Destiny's Child, some people came, some people left, sort of just developed from there. And we really started to like put the politics into it. We learned down the line that it takes a lot to do that, so just saying it isn't enough, and through a lot of trial and error and the help and the vocalization of our community, we were able to foster something that they need and that works well. So when we first started doing that, people didn't really like it and didn't understand, but for me, I've always wanted to take up space, and for me, I've always wanted to not be stopped just because it wasn't for me. That venue's really good, it's got great sound, it's in a great location, you know, I know I can make it work there, so let's go there. But obviously it does come with challenges, because the door staff aren't used to seeing queer people all the time, or the kind of people that we're bringing in, like 24/7 queer venues would be. It does come with challenges, but in my experience, it just taking up space just feels a lot better to me. And unfortunately, the queer venues that are out there aren't supported enough tech-wise for me to want to put my DJs on there.
What are the challenges that you're facing as a collective to kind of keep going and keep those ethics so integral to your collective despite financial difficulties or lack of support?
It has been really difficult, especially like in the beginning, because people didn't understand what we were trying to do. We were giving more work to the door staff because we want to kick people out, you know, if we have like zero tolerance of any harassment. So I didn't want us to have like gender neutral toilets, you know, all of these kind of things. But I think now we're into our fourth year technically, including the year that we did it in the house, so I feel like we've got a little bit of a reputation behind us now, so people know what to expect. Challenges that we still face are like gentrification, because you know, a mix is great for like lots of reasons, but I mean, that's going to get all that old area is going to get turned into flats in 2 years. So it just seems that everyone's getting pushed further out, further out, further out. you always have to sacrifice something, but at least you're not sacrificing yourself. Do you know what I mean? Like, at least you can still be yourself in that space as much as you can be compared to others.
Could you tell us a bit about how Pussy Palace is so vital as a space, especially for queer people of colour at this time?
Queer people of colour especially are, like, getting it from, like, all angles. So to have, like, a space that they are allowed to, like, disassociate and forget about the week, and they don't have to, like, worry about all of those microaggressions that still, like, exist inside the club when you're, like, when it's, like, a mixed party, or if it's, like, a white party or majority of, you know. So it's, you know, it provides that relaxation that helps you, like, deal with the week a little bit better, you know. And also to create community, like, a lot of people, even me, like, if I think about it, the reason that I pushed Pussy Palace so much was so that I could find my own queer people of colour community, which is what I did. And you see people come through and they are a little bit unsure at first, and then 3, 4, 5 parties later, a year down the line, they've got this whole, like, gang of friends, and they're really comfortable with their sexuality and their gender. And whereas before, one party ago or 1 year ago, they were unsure of it. So people should be, especially queer people of colour, should be allowed a space where they can experiment with their sexuality and gender and question it and start to explore it and meet people that also feel the same way and can support them through that journey.
The safe space policy has always been a really integral part of Pussy Palace, always highlighting it on Instagram posts and the run-up to events and physically in the space. Could you tell us why this is so important?
We don't actually like to use the word safe, so we use brave or safer, because, like, no place is really safe. Like, even though we've got all of those things on the policy, we still have problems with consent almost every single month. People forget themselves, or, you know, unfortunately, because our community isn't supported in other ways, when they come to Pussy Palace, maybe it's the only actually club night that they go to, or maybe it's because of previous sexual trauma that's happened in other clubs beforehand, or maybe, like, they're questioning their gender and sexuality and they feel a wee bit more, oh, here, this is where I am, this is where I belong. Then mix that with, like, drinking, all your emotions can come out on the dance floor, and sometimes that also makes you behave in ways that you don't normally. So all of those things that are on that policy, it is because of what we have to deal with the outside, but we also have those problems within our own community as well. So I don't really like to use the word safe, because nowhere's really safe, you know. As Pussy Palace started to be outside the house, and we started to get a handle on things, it was like a party that 150 people would come every month, and people who were coming knew who we were, and we're friends or friends of friends, understand what we were trying to do. But we got an article put out in Dazed, and it ended up bringing 600 people to the club night. And we were so unprepared. And it was a lot of people that read it was like, wow, this is for me. And they came down and there wasn't gender neutral toilets. There, you know, because we didn't put a sign up, because people just knew that they could use every toilet. The security guards were being really abusive to our guests. Like, we have got stamps that say Pussy Palace on it. And they were like, show us your pussy before you get in. And, like, stuff like this. It was disgusting. Loads of transphobia, loads of racism. Like, all the worst things that you could possibly happen at a night that I'm trying to do happened that night. So after that, we were like, it's not enough that people know us. We have to be really vocal and be really, you know, almost like militant with it, you know, and I can keep reminders. So that's how the policy came up. I'm really bad at writing, but it took me like 3 days and a lot of, like, consulting with lots of different friends, and that's how it ended up. We were actually updating it because I want to include things like, you know, drinking and drugs are, like, a big problem within our community, you know, so I want to, like, have things on there. I want to highlight that. I also want to put mention about consent, but for your friends as well. You know, like, you shouldn't be grabbing your friend's ass in the night just because, like, you know, you want to, you know. So consent is really important, but, you know, also within friends as well.
And do you think there's a reason why this model kind of, we haven't seen it everywhere, why it's not across the board?
I mean, I question that all the time, because even though it's queer politics, technically, like, all of those things can be applied everywhere. But, I mean, it's hard work. Like, we don't get paid, like, any extra for doing all that. And it's a lot of, like, emotional and hard labour sometimes to deal with all of those things. So I think it's really, really important, even if you still come across all those problems like we do, you know, because to push the message and to continue to remind, and also just to create a channel that this is the things that we like, these are the things that we don't like. But if those things happen to you, then here is a line for you to come and report and talk to us about it, and, you know, we can handle it and move forward from there.
So I'm joined here by Lucas La Rochelle, who is a designer based in Montreal and is the creator of Queering the Map.
Absolutely.
So Queering the Map is a community-generated countermapping project that archives queer moments, memories, and histories in relation to physical space. So put quite simply, it's an online platform which features a map onto which anyone can anonymously contribute stories of queer experience in relation to place by clicking a point on the map and adding a text-based description of that experience. On the emotional side, sort of the genesis of the project began on a particular bike ride, biking home from school one fall evening, and I biked by this tree in Parc Jean-Mance in Montreal, Jojage, where I live, and it was a tree where I met my first long-term partner. And it was also a tree at which I had a relatively explosive coming out in regards to my non-binary gender. And so it was this tree that held this very particular and multivalenced relationship to my experience of being a queer person. And so as I continued that bike ride, I began to think about all of the other places that held this kind of queer feeling for me. So thinking about this mysterious red shipping container by the by my childhood home, where my first love and I would meet to discuss our relationship and the barriers to its full expression, as he was not out at the time. I thought of the street by my high school, where when I would leave school for lunch and walk down that street, on almost every occasion would have homophobic or transphobic epithets hurled at me from moving cars and people on the street. And then I thought about more sort of traditionally understood queer spaces, like the bars and event spaces where I've met the people that constitute my queer community now. And so I began thinking quite deeply on what constitutes queer space and how we might move away from definitions of queer space as only specific stretches of streets, specific neighborhoods, specific locations, but rather think about how queer space exists in its ephemeral nature in relation to different places that are not necessarily legible as queer, and in relation to other people, whether they're within our community or not. And so I wanted to figure out a way to sort of open this question up to see if it was a question that other people were interested in or thinking about. And so I started developing Queering the Map.
I was wondering if you could tell us, why do you think it's important to record queer experiences?
I think it's important to record queer experience in all of its permutations because it's often something that is erased from history, particularly from archives. I mean, the myth of the internet in its early genesis was that it would be a place that would liberate us from our bodily limitations and positions and the oppressions that were located around our bodies on vectors of race, class, gender, ability, etc. And we obviously know that this is not the case, that the utopian impulses of the internet have definitely not panned out for a variety of reasons. But I still feel very animated by that initial utopian impulse of the possibilities of the internet as this liberatory or queer space. And so I'm very interested in, through projects like Queering the Map, coming back to those kinds of impulses. I think that the internet is, that there's very much the potential for it to be a queer space. I think that there are and have been many queer spaces on the internet and spaces that are particularly, that have always been under attack, but I think that we're in a particular moment where they're especially under attack. So Tumblr recently started banning a wide variety of content, specifically any content that's deemed sexual content. It was particularly terrifying seeing a lot of my friends posting, sort of speaking to the end of Tumblr, going through their Tumblr blogs and seeing all of the images that had been flagged for removal, including very nascent expressions of queerness, like a kiss. Not sure the exact number, but they've obviously lost an enormous amount of users following this crackdown on whatever it is that they deem to be unsafe content. And I think that we can sort of see this as an extension of FOSTA-SESTA, the law that I guess originated in the United States, which shut down Backpage.
It kind of almost feels like Tumblr was one of the last like utopian-esque platforms of like the web 1.0, and that really kind of held that promise of a utopian future for the internet. I guess you could compare that to Bebo, maybe, as well. Like, there's not really any platform right now that allows for that exploration to continue. So it is a shame.
The impulse that when one creates any sort of online platform or project, not that the intention of queering the map is in any way to be a sort of like equivalent to Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, but that there's this impulse that it has to operate on these mass scales, and that need huge amounts of infrastructure, huge amounts of funding in order to exist. And so I'm really interested in sort of experimental platform design that's community specific as the future of digital space, that it isn't about creating these like huge mega platforms or about small organizations being subsumed into these mega platforms. But I'm particularly interested in what's possible on a very small scale when people have access to, like, I'm very privileged to have access to education that allowed me to develop the skills to make this site possible. Queering the Map functions as a participatory digital space that isn't governed by larger infrastructures of control. I mean, the caveat of that being it sort of piggybacks, it uses Google Maps APIs, it participates in the stack, so by no means is it entirely outside of that. But I'm particularly interested in the ways in which new kinds of platforms that exist sort of as parasites on these sort of larger infrastructures of the internet. And not that I think it's a perfect example, but even sort of like particular Facebook groups. I mean, out of the numerous critiques of dominant social media platforms and the way that they particularly block access or make challenging access and participation by marginalized groups of people, one of the sort of issues that I was interested in confronting with Queering the Map, the necessitation of the individual on social media platforms and the ways in which social media platforms ask us to construct ourselves continuously as linear individuals, that we create sort of user profiles and we document our relationship to ourselves and to our community, but along this thorough line of identity. I mean, we can think of like the phenomenon of people creating Finstas as, I think, speaking to a particular exhaustion with this kind of performativity of being online, of being a person, of being an individual online, a sort of queer critique of the necessity of the individual on dominant social media platforms would argue that there is no such thing as the individual, that we're constructed relationally to our environments and to our communities and to our contexts. And so I was really interested in sort of mobilizing a queer critique of identity and a queer critique of individualism in the design of a social media space or a digital community. Thinking about what is asked of us when we have to perform ourselves in an online context, and the phenomenon of people creating, for example, Finstas, in which they post perhaps the less admirable or the less exciting or the less perfectly curated version of their life that would exist on their, what I've also heard referred to now as Rinstas, being their real Instagram. That kind of performance in the context of queerness necessitates that one, A, identify as queer all the time, fluidly, or consistently, and that it necessitates that that person is out. And it also often necessitates a particular amount of pride around that identity. But when one is anonymous, and I think that this is very much happens on Queering the Map, that there's the opportunity to express emotions, sentiments, experiences that one wouldn't necessarily post if it was clear the identity of the person who was posting. And I think, I mean, my own engagement, like I also use and post on Queering the Map, I post things on Queering the Map that I would never post to social media and perhaps wouldn't even tell people in real life. And so I think that there's the function of anonymity, aside, it's the obvious use of anonymity in terms of the safety of participants, is very much structured around thinking about what other modes of expression might be possible if anonymity is built into the interface. Which I got to sort of through a queer critique of identity and a queer critique of individualism. I mean, I think it's helpful to think of queering as a process of spoiling or ruining, because it's spoiling or ruining systems of oppression, such as white supremacy, such as cis patriarchy, that need to be spoiled or that need to be ruined. And the existence of queer bodies existing and thriving in space disrupts the ways in which space has been produced for particular people at the expense of other people. Mobilizing around this sort of negative conception of queerness, not as something that's trying to assimilate into structures of logic that are, to be blatant, fucked up, but rather as understanding that queer identity is something that should be antagonistic to these systems, and that we should resist the kind of horrifying neoliberalization of queer identity, particularly the assimilation of queer identities in Western contexts or mobilized in imperialism and through pinkwashing. Yeah.
Thank you. That was really well put, actually.
The Feminist Internet Podcast.
We are joined by Amy LeMay, who's Night Tsar of London. Could you tell us a little bit about your role as Night Tsar in London and maybe the responsibilities that you have?
I was appointed by the Mayor of London in November 2016 to promote, advocate for, and have a strategic overview of London at night. And that encompasses everything from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. A lot of people think that my job really just entails bars, pubs, and clubs. That's the fun side of it, but also, you know, serious business matter as well. And I have a watching brief over things like transport, workers' rights, the environment. Every single aspect of our lives at night is something that is in my watching brief. So it's not just the kind of traditional what we might think of as night, but it's much, much broader than that. So the kinds of thing, I mean, no day is ever the same, which is really exciting. And I have to stress that I work day and night.
What actions do you try and take to represent everyone in London's nightlife?
Actually, making sure that I represent all Londoners is absolutely essential to what I do. And it's at the very heart of what I do. And it's at the very heart of everything that the mayor does. Everything has to look like London. And if you look at London and look at what London is made of, it's made up of people from diverse backgrounds, from every corner of the world, speaking so many different languages of every shade, hue, religion, background. And so we all go the extra mile to make sure that whatever we do looks like London. I mean, a big part of what I do is working to save venues and ensuring that different communities have safe spaces to express themselves in at night. And that includes women. So one of the actions that I've done is put together with the mayor Women's Night Safety Charter that we have. I think there's 50 organizations and businesses signed up so far, and we're working very hard to get more for this year. We hold an annual Women's Night Safety Summit at City Hall. This year will be the third year. Although we are overwhelmingly safe in London, women don't always feel safe. So we need to close that gap between perception and reality. I also work really hard to save LGBT venues, which is something that's really near and dear to my heart, and making sure that the LGBT community has safe spaces to express themselves.
And I guess you know the kind of really shocking statistic that 58% of LGBT venues have closed in the last decade. And I thought, with your expertise, do you think you have an angle to kind of think about why queer venues are facing such issues?
That piece of research that was done by University College London Urban Lab was something that the mayor co-commissioned. You know, this was a subject that I was acutely aware of. The first campaign that I ran to save an LGBT space was in 1997, and that was when the Royal Vauxhall Tavern was under threat back in the 90s. And so I'm now on my third decade of working to save LGBT spaces. And the fact that I'm still here, still around, and using all of the knowledge that I've built up over years to help not just the RVT, but spaces all over London, this is something that I feel really passionately about. When I started as Night Tsar, I flagged this as something that was really important, and we needed the statistics. So the great people at UCL Urban Lab did this piece of research, which gave us this figure, this very shocking figure that we've lost 58% in the last 10 years. And as a result of that, because we had the data, we were able to say, look, this isn't just queer people running around saying, stop closing our venues. This is actual fact. And we have to respond to this. These are places that help our community be more resilient. It helps us be safe. It helps us be ourselves. So this is something that the mayor feels really strongly about as well. So I feel really great that we've got such a wonderful LGBT ally in the mayor. And so we have now a culture at risk officer. And that culture at risk officer and I work very closely together. And over the past 2 years now, I guess, we have worked on over 200 nighttime venues to save them. And a proportion of those are LGBT venues. Some of the cases you might know about, the Joiner's Arms. We also this week found out that there's a new LGBT bar opening in Wimbledon. Wimbledon's first LGBT space, which is brilliant. So that to me says that the work that we're doing is creating resilience in the sector. It's making people feel more confident. It's making people feel like, yes, you know, there are the LGBT communities out there that want to be in these spaces.
It seems that a positive future for queer space is kind of giving the agency and structure to small groups and individuals to set up their own spaces.
Yeah, well, one of the things we've been looking at is actually inviting more promoters into the venues forum to help share best practice. Because, you know, often with the intersectionality of the LGBT queer world, you know, not everybody has the luxury of having a space. It's important to save those spaces and to keep them, but also it's important to make sure that the people that are in those spaces are from diverse communities. This is something that we very much want to happen, is to invite more promoters who tend to be from the QTPOC community, who tend to be doing one-off nights or, you know, monthlies or things like that, that might not even be based in an LGBT venue. They might be in a straight venue, to bring them into the fold. I think together we're all stronger. You know, this isn't about exclusivity. It's about bringing the whole community together. Yeah, under a big rainbow flag with every color in it. Every color that anybody wants in the rainbow flag.
What's your vision for London's queer nightlife in the future? Apart from the rainbow flag of every color.
I know, you know, not everybody likes the rainbow flag, but I use it as a symbol to illustrate the kind of diversity and also the, you know, the debate that's going on around, should we add more colors to it? Should we not? Who needs their own flag? Who doesn't? And these are, I guess, like it or not, they're important symbols of our community. And I think it's important they're as inclusive as possible. I think for the LGBT community and for our spaces in the future, I'd like to see them grow. I feel really proud that we've been able to stem the flow of closures. You know, we have stability now for the first time. I mean, last year we actually saw tiny green shoots of growth. We saw three new venues open. This year we've got at least one. And so that to me shows that we're turning that big queer ocean liner around very slowly, but I'd rather do it slowly and surely rather than do it quickly and everything fall apart again. You know, we got into this situation because there are so many threats to our spaces, and there are threats like development, like rise in business rates, rise in rents. A lot of these things are out of my control and out of the mayor's control. So what we can do is try and just convene people, get people together, make our community stronger, and so we can work together to overcome this. And, you know, I think the future is bright, to be honest. And a couple of years ago, we were in a pretty bad place. But I think we've turned a bit of a corner, slowly, surely.
If a promoter or like a small collective wanted to get involved in the conversations that were happening, how could they do so?
They can email, or they can go onto the mayor's website. So you can email knight@london.gov.uk. Drop us a line. I have to be clear, this isn't, it's not a group for campaigns. It's a group for promoters and venue owners and operators. Well, I feel really proud to be the Knight Czar of a city that is the most diverse in the world and has the most diverse culture at night in the world. And it's what makes London, London. And without it, we lose that edge that we have over every single other city in the world, our diversity. That's why it's important to make sure that we keep our community spaces. That's why it's important that we look after people that work at night, who actually make our nights out happen. You know, the people that are driving the tube trains and collecting the rubbish and, you know, cooking our food and doing all the bits behind the scenes to ensure that, you know, what we see as nightlife is able to carry on and continue. And it's about raising the bar for everybody at night as well. If you think night is 6 p.m. to 6 a.m., I mean, this is, you know, how we define it. That's half our lives. Our nighttime economy in London is growing faster than the economy during the day. And these are, you know, this is what we know from the most in-depth data study that we've done at City Hall on any city at night in the world. And so we know that 1.6 million people are working at night. That's one in three working Londoners are usually working at night. And so we ignore them at our peril. I mean, this is a valuable resource for us in our city. And we have to make sure that, you know, we up the bar for everybody working at night, so that everybody who's going out at night, doing what they want to do at night, is able to do that with a good conscience and knowing that, you know, we're trying to close that gap of inequality.
The Feminist Internet Podcast.
So I'm joined here by Jim McSweeney, who's the manager of Gaze the Word Bookshop in London.
I joined Gaze the Word in 1989, almost 30 years ago, and I became the manager about 1997. The bookshop was founded in 1979, so it's our 40th anniversary. The idea goes back to about 1968-69, when a young man called Ernest Hole was in New York for a few months and became friends with Craig Rodwell, who had set up the Oscar Wilde Memorial Bookshop. And the Oscar Wilde Memorial Bookshop is the first of the modern gay bookshops. Ernest, he actually came back the following year and arrived the day after the Stonewall riots. And Craig Rodwell said, it's all kicking off. And Ernest went to the very first Gay Liberation Front meeting. The year after the Stonewall riots, Craig was one of the initiators of the Christopher Street Memorial Parade, which becomes what we now know as Pride. When Ernest came back to London, he thought, wouldn't it be a wonderful idea to have a bookshop like that here? And it took a few years. He ran some bookstalls and stuff. And eventually he settled on a place in Marchmont Street. Looked at Covent Garden first. Thank God he didn't go there, as we'd have been priced out a long time ago. And with very little money, set up this community space. The first third of the bookshop, if you know it, was lesbian, gay and feminist right from the very start. And all of the rest was meeting space. And before Gay's the Word, a gay bookshop tended to be a male space that was adult, with lots of magazines. And we were different. The very first advert says, London's serious gay bookshop is now open. So there was no porn. When I first went to the bookshop in 1983 as a young man coming out, the back of the bookshop was a seating area with lots of huge notice boards. At a time, you know, there's no internet, so where you found information on how to find flats, or there was personal ads, places to go, clubs, etc. Soho hasn't started as a gay space. I mean, that happens in the 90s. So you came to Gaze the Word looking for flats or maybe work, you know, places where it was okay to be gay. Many groups used the shop back in the early days. One of the original workers founded the Gay Black Group. There was a lesbian discussion group, which has been meeting since, I think, about 1980. That was women talking to one of the managers at the time, Amanda, complaining about the lack of women's spaces. As ever, there's always more gay male spaces. So she set up a discussion group and thought, it's been running ever since, every Wednesday at 8. And we get women coming in saying, is it still running? Are you still talking about coming out? This is my wife, who I met there 10, 15 years ago. And it makes a difference. I had this really nice customer. She was buying a book, I think, on Rumi. And I said, oh, we've got a lesbian discussion group meeting on Wednesdays. And she burst into tears and said, you're so lucky. And she was from Morocco, where it's difficult, obviously, to be lesbian or gay. And then we talked for 20 minutes. And it was just that space to exchange, you know, feelings, and I listened a lot. And hopefully she went out from that space strengthened, knowing all around her there were LGBT people coming into the shop as a matter of course and just being themselves. Back in the day, lots of the early prides were organised at Gays the Words. After we closed in the evening, you know, people would come and use it as a meeting space. And of course, probably most famously, Lesbians and Gays Support the Miners used to meet there. I mean, they quickly outgrew the space and then went to the Fallen Angel, which was a lefty pub in Islington, and they had an upstairs room there. In the film Pride, it's as if they only met at Gays the Word. No, we were there for part of the time, but they always collected money outside the bookshop, and a lot of them had already knew each other because they'd met at Gays the Word at other meetings. There used to be a young gay socialist group. In about 97, when I took over as manager, we'd run out of space for books, and I got rid of the seating area. So we made more space for books, and these days we have lots of groups meeting there. So groups like Trans London, they meet once a month, and that was a wonderful customer who was asking about trans groups. And I said, well, you're welcome to start one. And she took up the mantle, and off it went. And it's, again, changed lives. I know. Even without working at Gays the Word, Gays the Word changed my life. When I went there in 83 and went to Icebreakers, which is a gay socialist group, and thought about politics for the first time, and read, and met friends, and went to the pub afterwards and had a laugh. But it was much less intimidating than going into a bar by myself. I made a connection of friends who were still my friends, you know, more than 30 years later.
What's the future for Gays the Word?
God knows. 10 years ago, our time was almost up. We thought that was it and we were ready to close. And we put out word, and it's before crowdfunding, we put out word to say, oi, use it or lose it. And then sponsor a shelf, and the response was extraordinary. And it let people know, you take things for granted when you're there a long time. And suddenly people came in and started using the shop again. Because you can get books anywhere. And what do you value about a particular gay bookshop? And, you know, LGBT bookshops have closed all over the world. So we've gone from being groundbreaking and important to becoming forgotten to suddenly becoming iconic. But it's not iconic where you come and take a photograph. You come to the bookshop because it's fantastic. It's got a huge range of books. And it's fun and it's vibrant and we do great events. We've never been so busy. And there are 30 years and we've never been so... We've almost outgrown the space, except I'd hate to move from there because it's got such a history.
I'm joined here with Ingo Kandu, who is the creator of Whatever World and Bar Whatever, which is a queer performance night at the Royal Vauxhall Tavern.
So Whatever World is something I started now 16 years ago, out of the necessity for me and my friends to have a space to go to, and the thought of being, you know, lesbians, gay men, trans, or various sort of like state of transitioning, but trans women, trans men, and being in London and not having a place where we all could go out together, even with us, you know, like workmates and people we like to hang with. There were no places where we could all go together and then sort of like have the chance to pull. So the idea of the whole thing, setting it together, was so simple, as in I wanted to create, and we did events under Club Whatever umbrella for all of us who wanted to have a chance to go out and socialise and be seen, and with possibilities of flirts and things like that without being harassed or beaten. What I mentioned there is something I now can see due to Brexit, due to kind of like, you know, regeneration, due to austerity. And that is kind of over the last years. So the beginning of Whatever, the idea was, you know, we were all from all other places and we stayed in London for a few months, or, you know, that energy made London in my eyes. And now it's harder for people from outside UK to actually finding space and platforms here. So we're using other people's spaces all the time and have done all these years. And the difference of using, you know, already established queer venues or building venues out of kind of necessity, we kind of always planted all our energies with performance art, with arts and crafts, with our bodies and information into other places. I'm always fighting this, you know, DIY culture, you know, queer, DIY, do it yourself, the punk mentality. We're not really needing much more than functioning toilets and a space to be in, literally. And that was the beginning, and it was a certain energy for that. And then we could queer up spaces. We used pubs, we used, you know, whatever places we could find and doing that in. And within the concept of whatever it is, the socializing and also, you know, creating platforms for performance. So the whole idea was, in the beginning, dress up, make an effort to go to these things, and therefore meeting people that are of similar ink or would like to hang together. But doing that with performance, everyone is seeing something on stage and we have a shared memory, we have a shared experience of the evening that is also drawing people together that not necessarily otherwise would meet. And for me, it has always been really, really important to working with that whole thing of we are all transitioning. And it can be gender transitioning. I'm not going to say one gender to another, but kind of like 18 years ago when we started, that is how people talked back then. You went from one to the other. But we were many who were also staying in the middle of genderqueer or, you know, doing our thing. And now we're using the word non-binary. We're transitioning through kind of like understanding and knowledge, but we're also transitioning through becoming older, having different needs. We're transitioning through sexuality or, you know, relationships as being single, together with someone, mono, and then polyamorous. The whole concept of movement was not reflected in the kind of like London we had around back then. And that is what whatever stood for and still stand for. Whilst nowadays, 2019, there are way more acceptance of all those kind of like ground ideas or ground thoughts that we brought together. So for us, it was really important to visualize and giving space for people who otherwise would not going out or be seen or put on stage.
At Bar Whatever, there's a lot of different forms of queer performance and drag. And I suppose the performative nature of drag itself can lead to a lot of complex questions. How do you think queer performance and drag affects our understanding of gender?
It's really important. So I've always said, or, you know, believed in what you put up on stage is also educating. So over the years, I've seen the development in understanding for both gender, but sexuality, by mental health issues, by well-being, by kind of like issues in our everyday life. If we put it on stage in kind of like some expression, and that can be in the way of drag, it can be in the way of just going up there with a piece of paper and reading something and not sort of like creating a persona or otherness. So that is super important, has been super important for our community, and that is what has molded it, and that is how we're many times sharing, you know, information and educating, and we make ourselves valid by both being in a venue where you see things on stage that you recognize, but also if you are on stage, you're seeing the reaction from the audience that they recognize what you are saying and makes you valid. Everything Bar Whatever and whatever is doing is lifting people up.
So it's like a two-way exchange.
100%. You can't have a performance without an audience. And you can't. It would be a sad audience without a performer. But it is a give and take.
From what I've experienced at the few times at Bar Whatever, there's a real sense of community that come together through the event. and this is really expressed through the community news section of the night. You really see that people don't just come and go to have a good time, like everyone's there to contribute in a way. So I was wondering, why did you create the community news segment?
Because it is important. It's important we shared information and knowledge. From the starter bar, whatever, and you know, all the years we've done, it has not really, we haven't had a magazine that suited all of us. We haven't had our kind of special other platform where all of our ideas and thoughts can be seen and read by other people who we don't know personally. You need to meet people you otherwise wouldn't maybe meet. And the community news is that. It's education and information. And when we started Bar Whatever, started at a very small pub in King's Cross called Central Station. When the owners of that place, you know, they're like, yeah, nothing is happening on Tuesdays anyway, so yeah, sure, you can test doing a queer night. By history, Tuesdays, or, you know, those ugly nights of the week that no one else can fill a venue, us queers, and this is a world-known thing, we always give that sort of odd days of the week where otherwise no one would go out. And in London, it's sort of like Mondays are normally a student night, Tuesdays queer or odd things on, Wednesdays weekend kind of burlesque, you know, like more established things are happening. Thursday, it's almost weekend. Then Friday and Saturdays are the big commercial times. Sundays are traditionally quite sort of like calm down or, you know, like family orientated kind of things. So that is how normally the week are going within
knock on
the
wood,
I did there, maybe that sounded
underground
bad.
But
so knock on wood, they said nothing else is happening on a Tuesday. We had a community and we wanted to lift up that community, and by doing so, getting people on stage and sharing what they were involved in made that community. The audience are participating in creating the night, so the audience are not never at Bar Whatever. They are never kind of like just spectators that sit back and entertain me now. The audience are super important because we are the audience. And when you have been there, you know. A lot of our performers are there when they are not performing, supporting each other. So that is also creating a we feeling or community feeling. Queer spaces are always going to be needed because we need to meet face to face. We can't always be... People can, but I see more and more things popping up in Zone 3 or Zone 4 or outside kind of central London. And doing those things, more and more people are using, you know, going to a straight pub or a pub that not necessarily doing things for queer people normally, but taking over for special events or special kind of like happenings. Money is sparse for everyone, and I think a lot of places are very happy to accommodate sort of like LGBTQIA promoters and IDs. So I think that is also changing a lot, that we can go elsewhere, as long as they do it on our terms and, you know, understanding the concept of, you know, openness and security. So queer spaces are always going to be needed because we need to meet face to face. We can't always be online because you can't hug someone as you can hug someone if you see them and they tell you they are feeling shit or whatever. You know, you can't take that away. So you're always going to need meeting spaces, information, solidarity, and also expanding your own knowledge. In an ideal world, we will have shitloads of more queer spaces, open and welcoming and understanding concepts with different flavors or, you know, ideas or thoughts around it. Meaning nowadays, the ones that survive as, how to say, 7-night-a-week queer spaces, can tend to be kind of like doing things only towards one demographic. So it also takes a lot from, you know, the owners of spaces that are queer to who do you want to see here? Would you like to have only one type of customer? Or would you actually be brave enough to open up and being open for everyone? And it's an example there I really would like to lift up, you know, the glory. And Johnny and John, who kind of like, and you know, the people behind the glory. Because it's, as far as I know, one of the most successful, like, performers or people within the community themselves opening up a venue. And that is kind of, I think, what all of us dream of doing. And I think they have really succeeded by doing that. You know, Dawson Superstore, there are a few others as well that have been doing that and are really successful. But I'm working a lot with the glory, and the amount of effort that they make sure that all of us are welcome there is like, you know, how a lot of people should react and try to make their audience be as wide as possible, because they are open for everything. And that is the way forward.
If you're coming to these spaces and if you're like engaging in these spaces, what Ingo and Amy said, that it is inherently political. We are in a crisis in terms of our queer spaces, and we are in damage control. I think now is the time for queer groups, promoters, managers, creators, DIY spaces, you know, whatever you want to call them, these small queer collectives, to be having conversations together in the development of cities. It's not really the best time for us to be dispersed. I just want to say I'm also really super grateful to all our guests for sharing their stories. You know, some of them are very personal. It's not very easy to do. I hope that listeners can take some action away with them, that if they need to find a queer space, they're not alone, and that there are queer spaces out there, and that is possible to do through the internet as well to begin with. I hope young queer people, older queer people, whoever, you know, needs this in their life right now, know that these places exist and that they're open and that they are listening, whether that be a bookshop, a club night, or a web browser. We just wanted to end with a beautiful quote by Cuban American author and academic Jose Munoz. Queerness is not here yet. Queerness is an identity. Put another way, we are not yet queer. We may never touch queerness, but we can feel it as the warm illumination of a horizon imbued with potentiality. We have never been queer, yet queerness exists for us as an identity that can be distilled from the past and used to imagine a future. The future is queerness's domain. Until next time, XOXO, peace out, party. Later. Studio.